Hello, everyone. This is Mike Quinsey, Connecting the Light. My guest today is Duncan Lunan, and we're going to discuss his book about the medieval mystery of the Green Children of Woolpit, which is a place in East Anglia near Suffolk. And in the late 12th century, two very strange children came out of an ancient earthwork at the village of Woolpit. The children wore clothing of a colour and material never seen before, spoke a language nobody recognised, and were coloured green all over. Now, everybody loves the mystery, including me, so I hope we can learn a bit more about this one from Duncan. Welcome to the programme, Duncan.
Thank you, Michael. Good to be here.
Yes. Now, I can remember reading about this at various times, and I must say there didn't appear to be a lot of evidence for it, although I must say I didn't disbelieve it, but you must have put in quite a lot of hours research to produce your book. And I think one of the areas that surprises me is that you were able to trace the descendants of these children up to the present day. Perhaps you'd like to tell us a bit about that.
Yes, if we go from the beginning of it, I discovered this when I was a student back in the 1960s in the astronomy section of The Anatomy of Melancholy, which was written by Robert Burton in the early 17th century. He's talking about the plurality of worlds and how exciting it is that the planets have been shown to be worlds in their own right, and the possibility of space travel arises. And of course, if God has created other worlds, as Burton saw it from his viewpoint, then they must be inhabited. They had to have a purpose, and that was the only purpose he could envisage. And then you get this wonderful throwaway line. It may be that those green children which fell from the sky that Newbegensis writes of in his time came from thence. Hmm. The footnotes in the modern edition tell you that Newbegensis is William of Newburgh, considered to be a reliable 12th century chronicler, and that there is another version of the story written by another chronicler considered reliable called Ralph of Coggeshall. So over the years I'd consulted the Latin texts of both of those, and I realized there definitely was a story here, because the children gave an account of themselves eventually when they had learned our manner of speaking, and they described an upbringing on a planet that definitely wasn't Earth, which was why Burton put it in his astronomy section. So, having known about this for the best part of 30 years, in the early 90s, I was covering a conference in London for at the British National Space Centre for the Glasgow Herald, and I decided that this was the time to do something about it. I took a bus from London up to Bury St Edmunds and another one out to the village of Woolpit. And before I thought I would just get some local colour for an article. I didn't expect to find anything more. But before I went, I got together with a friend of mine who's a history graduate, and we'd worked out a list of questions. So I was made very welcome in the village, and they opened up the local history museum out of season for me, and I kept asking these questions. And people kept replying. You would have to go to the county records office for that kind of information. So I went back into Bury St Edmunds, and I signed up with the County Archives Research Network, and they said, right, the card index is over here, tell us what you want to see. And 5 hours later, starving and dried out and exhausted, I reeled out into Bury St Edmunds Market, saying to myself, I'm onto something big, because it was clear that nobody had taken quite this line of inquiry before, and the questions had answers. In fact, there was a trail to follow, which I spent 10 years doing. As you say, I've brought it down to the stage now where I've identified quite a number of the the characters in the story, and I've established that whatever this was, it really happened. And I have even traced a couple of descendants of the Green Girl who are alive today. I've traced two lines of descent down to the present.
Right.
So, your move.
So, yes, so the boy apparently died quite young, but the girl married, and I don't know whether she had children or if you found out that, but presumably she must have done to have had descendants.
Yes. Well, this is just one of the many indications that you're really onto something here, is that she married one of Henry II's senior ambassadors. Mm. And at that point, the entire class of explanation that says these children were runaways from a tribe in the woods, you know, disappears. It's clear that we're into something much bigger. In fact, it turns out, among other things, that the authorities of the day were expecting something to happen. Henry II had annexed the village of Woolpit from Bury St. Edmunds Abbey, who owned it, and, as it seemed, had refused two commands from the Pope to give it back. Although, when you read the papal letters, what they actually say is rather different. And basically, they say, we've ordered the king to give it back when he's finished with it, which is rather a different story. Mm. But the supposedly, the cover story for this was that Henry II had a poor clerk who needed the income from the village, which was worth £10 a year. But the, quote, poor clerk that he assigned it to was the Vice-Chancellor of England, who was just about the richest man in the country, a man who was expected to entertain foreign dignitaries at his own expense and would think nothing, even in those days, of spending £1,000 on a banquet, you know, and was really not stuck for £10 a year. Mm. And then Ralph of Coggeshall tells us that the children were taken to the home of Lord Richard de Calna, a sort of knight. And he's very difficult to trace because essentially, well, the big thing is he was excused all taxes by Henry II long before this happened. So he effectively disappears from the record. He's like the head of the Secret Service.
Yeah.
And to get to his land, the villagers would have had to cross the land of two other barons. So they clearly knew where they were going. And that there would be a reward for them at the end of it. And again, the fact that somebody of his caliber would take an interest in the Green Children and take them into his household and make himself responsible for them tells you again that this is all part of something much bigger. Because de Calna was a man of great influence. It takes a bit of figuring out how he got to be a knight, because his family were all bishops and archbishops. That was the background that he came from. But he was special, and clearly so were the children.
Yes, right. So,
and in reply to what you said before, yes, she did indeed have children. She had two sons.
Right. So she married an official named Richard Barr.
That's right.
And you were able to trace that family name forward.
Mm-hmm. In fact, something quite dramatic happened. I did write my article, which was published in Analog, the science fiction and fact magazine, to which I'm an occasional contributor. And at that point, I had only traced her descendants as far as nearly the middle of the 14th century. And it looked at that point as if the trail had gone cold. But after the article was published, I was contacted by a chap in the US forces who had been researching his family history. Because he was a descendant of George Washington. that turns out to be on a different line, but the George Washington's family had married with the family of the Shirleys, who were the Earls Ferrers, and an earlier link was with the Devereux family, one of whom had married a woman called Anne Barr in 1340. And going back to the Shirley family records, I found everything joined up. In fact, this Anne Barr was one of the last descendants of the Green Girl, Agnes Barr, whom I had been able to trace. And so the family tree of the Shirley family just dovetailed perfectly with the family tree of her descendants as I'd got so far. It was clear from the number of names and places that they had in common that this was exactly the same woman. And so suddenly we had this situation where, as well as the chap who'd contacted me, we also had the Shirley family as descendants of Agnes. And I said as much in a talk that I gave to the Fortean Society on convention in London in 1997. Various papers covered the story. It got pretty good press coverage in quality papers, The Observer and The Sunday Telegraph. But initially, the only one with the bottle to name the Earl, who had been one of, he'd actually been deputy leader of the House of Lords under Margaret Thatcher. The only paper that had the nerve to name him and out him in this sense was the Evening Times in Glasgow. And they rang him up and said, are you aware of this? And he took it extremely well, I have to say, but he gave them a wonderful quote in reply. He said, it sounds bizarre. I knew my ancestors were colourful, but not that colourful.
Yes, very good.
So I wrote to him and I said, well, I'm very glad you've taken this in good part, but this is actually on that level quite serious. I can add more than 200 years to your family tree on that side. And he wrote back basically saying, never mind all that boring stuff. Tell me about the Green Woman from outer space. So
right.
he did take it very well, which was nice, because I'd been wondering how on earth to approach him.
Right. Now, you say the woman from out of space, but I understand there is a report that says the two children actually came out of a cave.
Well, not a cave. Ralph of Coggeshall says that in adult life, when asked how she got to Woolpit, the girl said that they'd wandered through a network of caves. Now, there are no caves at Woolpit. The village stands on Pleistocene clay. The water table's only 3 feet or so below the surface. It wasn't until relatively modern times that buildings even had foundations. They used to build them on rafters, on floats, in effect. But what she had said originally when she was asked about it was that this had happened to her and her brother because they were out with their father's livestock on a certain day, with a very strong implication that, you know, they shouldn't have been out in the fields that day, wherever they were. And it was because of that act of disobedience, basically, that they landed up where they were. And they heard a great sound like the sound that they now heard, which was the bells of Bury St. Edmunds. They heard a sound of bells. And then, suddenly, as if placed in some absence of mind, we found ourselves in the field where you were reaping. I think the fascinating thing about that is, this kid not only knows what amnesia is, but she knows she hasn't got it, as if placed in some absence of mind. And again, you know, it blows the primitive runaway theory away. She was obviously educated even before she got here. And So as it seems, what you've got is some kind of matter transmitter accident. Astonishing though it might seem. But it happened at a time of very intense solar activity when the Earth's magnetic field was greatly disturbed. And physicists I've spoken to say that there could well be a connection there.
Hmm. Well, just following that point through a little further, I mean, on our Earth, there are incidents of people disappearing and reappearing many, many miles away. Do you think the children perhaps were in caves in their own level, and then something happened and they, in a manner of speaking, just jumped dimensions?
That's possible, because the original Latin texts are very condensed, and they could have multiple layers of meaning. In Ralph's account, when she says that they were out herding their father's animals, the verb she uses is sequerentur, which can be translated as the animals were being followed. Mm-hmm. And when she then says, because of that, we went down into a cave, it could mean that there was a predator prowling around the herd and they decided to take cover. But as I said, she didn't mention the caves in the original story when she was talking about it as a child. She said this had happened instantaneously. And my own feeling is that the caves are probably added because it was safer to say, "Oh, we got there through some caves. Yeah, mm-hmm. We don't know how. We can't find them again." That kind of thing.
Right. I mean, you've evidently mentioned in your book about mass abductions from Earth. This is part of, I think, the part where you speculate on different ideas. Do you actually think extraterrestrials could be involved in any way at all?
Oh, yes. I think on the face of it, I mean, these children are definitely human. And yet, what they described when... going into a little bit of background here, and the two Latin texts at this point go into very formal language, and what modern writers have been translating as "she said" and "they said" is actually gave evidence of that and swore on oath that. And it turns out this would have been before their christening, and even today in controversial circumstances in the Catholic Church this still happens, there would have been a formal hearing conducted by a bishop. And there comes a point where everything seems to be going fine, and the bishop evidently asks one last question: "Does the sun rise and set where you come from?" And all she had to say was yes, because the point of the question was that at that time there was supposed to be no sun in fairyland. All she had to say was, "Yes, the sun rises and sets just as it does here." But instead she said no. And at that point, there must have been a real shiver went through the room. And she went on to describe, she said, "We live in a condition of permanent twilight. And not far from where we live, there's a very broad river. And on the other side of it, it's permanent sunlight." So, in fact, what we're talking about, as it seems, is life in the twilight zone of a planet that's keeping the same face always towards its star. So it's not in our solar system at all. It would seem from this that if she's living in a human settlement in that situation, we're either dealing with time travel or somebody has made this happen. Somebody has taken them and put them there, presumably for experimental purposes, which is where the hints about the predators and the food they couldn't eat and all the rest of it does imply that it's some kind of experiment that's going on.
Right.
So that's what I've suggested in the book.
Yeah. Now, I'm guessing here that what would have been a terrific find on your part would if you had discovered where Agnes, the green girl, was buried, because I guess these days with their forensic tests, etc., they could have established whether she was 100% human or whatever. Did you pursue that?
I tried. We know where she was when she died. She and her husband in the second half of their lives took over his family's estate at Little Bar, north of Birmingham. And the last record of her is in 1238, after which the property changes hands and, you know, things move on, and it's clear that's her exit from the scene. The trouble is that whole area was massively redeveloped during the Industrial Revolution. And sad to say, there are no medieval relics there at all. Churchyards and everything have gone.
Right.
So for the moment, that seems to be a dead end.
I mean, would there have been any better chance of finding out what happened to the boy's body?
Well, again, the evidence is circumstantial, but it looks as if he died very shortly after the hearing. In fact, they probably brought it forward to make sure that they were both christened before he died. And the most likely place for him to be buried was at Coggeshall Abbey, where Ralph of Coggeshall subsequently wrote the story up. And I've got a double whammy here. One is that within the last 20 years, the abbey, which has been converted into a farmhouse, has been owned by a family who decided to put in a swimming pool. So they dug up the cemetery, which caused quite a bit of ill feeling locally. The other thing is, however, that it does seriously look, in the records of Coggeshall Abbey, as if there was a raid by the Knights Templar on the cemetery. And my guess is they came for the boy's body and took it away. It's within a couple of years of his death. And I strongly suspect that's what they were after.
Mm.
So it may not have...
Yeah. That's a pity, isn't it, really? But, I mean, the amount of information you've picked up and been able to explore makes it into a more fuller story. Certainly some more information there than I can recall. Now,
Hugely, yes. I filmed a program for the National Geographic Ancient X-Files, which last I heard was nearly ready.
Oh.
But they haven't got any of this in it. They decided just to use me to introduce the mystery. So the all of this material that we've been talking about, which I discovered, is not yet in that sense on camera. But I'm going to be filming again at Woolpit next month, and I'm hoping that one will be I hope it will go into what I've discovered a bit more. That would be nice.
What does that mean? You make a film privately and then sell it to one of the TV companies?
No, TV companies have approached me in both cases.
I see. Right, yes.
Sorry, you're breaking up there.
Sorry?
Our sound quality's deteriorated.
Oh, I can hear you quite well.
That's okay. Well, I got that. Can you put your question again?
Yes, I was asking about the film that you're going to make next month and whether you would sell it to the TV companies. You said no, that they've asked you to do it. Now, do you already know how that would be released?
Well, I don't know. I'd better not say too much at the moment since it hasn't happened yet, but I understand it will be available as a DVD for domestic use in the United States.
Oh, right. That's interesting. I guess if it went down very well, it would soon come out here as well.
Yes, I would imagine so. When you, yes, I should think there will be quite a lot of interest in this one when it happens.
Now, one of the things you did mention was that I think prior to the arrival of the two children, there had been some strange things happening in the sky. What was that about?
Well, essentially, in the period from round about the 1140s to the 1240s, that century, that was the biggest series of disturbances on the sun since the Bronze Age. The second largest disturbances on the sun in recorded history. The Earth, as a result of that, the Earth's magnetic field was greatly disturbed. People were seeing the Aurora Borealis all the way down to Syria and seeing red aurora, which indicates high energy particles penetrating the atmosphere all the way down there, which is really quite extraordinary. Even here on the latitude of Glasgow, we very rarely see colours in the Aurora Borealis, but they were seeing it right down through Europe and down into the Middle East. And the Chinese records and Japanese and Korean records have naked eye sunspots visible. And altogether, conditions in the Earth-Sun relationship were extremely fraught at the time. This shows up in tree rings and glacial ice deposits and all kinds of indicators. It's confirmed in a lot of different ways. So it's clear that in that regard, some very strange things and spectacular things were happening in the sky. And at the same time, there were comets virtually every year, and meteor showers and all kinds of stuff going on. Big impacts on the moon in 1178, and clearly something was happening. Putting it all together is the fun part. That's where the speculation comes in.
Yes, so you could speculate that with all those electrical or magnetic disturbances going on, it might have had some bearing on the appearance of these two children.
Well, very much so, because if they were indeed from a planet with a trapped rotation, you would expect it to have no magnetic field. Planet Venus rotates very slowly and has no magnetic field. Mm. And if you've got no magnetic field at one end and powerful magnetic disturbances at the other, then yes, you might very well think that if there was a matter transmitter link, a portal, if you will, that accidents would happen. And indeed, this doesn't seem to be the only case. I've found a handful of other incidents in the medieval chronicles that seem to be connected, it's all as it seems part of a pattern.
Right. Now, just getting back to the idea of extraterrestrials, perhaps, being involved in some of these peculiar things, you did speculate that in medieval times there might have been mass abductions from Earth. Now, did you have any basis of evidence to put that forward, or is that purely from your own sort of thinking?
It's speculation. The children in both chronicles talk about herding their father's livestock, which implies some kind of a settlement. And the girl also at one point referred to all of the people who were held in that land. So it's clearly quite a large group. There's nothing to indicate directly just how large, but if you were wanting to establish a long-term settlement of human beings, you would probably want to be thinking in terms of a gene pool of several thousand people. And we're at the end of a very disturbed, when we're looking at these dates, we're at the end of a very disturbed period in English medieval history, where huge numbers of people just vanished. And during the civil war between Stephen and Matilda, for instance, Essex was effectively depopulated. And so was the north of England at least twice due to invasions from Scotland. And then during the Crusades, the historians talk quite casually about hundreds of thousands of people setting off on Crusades and just disappearing without trace. So it could be that a very large number have been spirited away during that without attracting notice. So I haven't got direct evidence for it, but it's possible.
Yes, in light of what you've said, definitely. That's interesting. I must say, in our current period of time, with the evidence of abductions or people being taken up, I don't personally feel they are all abductions as such. I've never considered that when you look back, that it could have already been happening, but of course there's no reason why not. In fact, I guess the disappearance of people in those days would have been less noticed than it is now.
Yeah. I think one of the fascinating things about this story, as compared with modern UFO sightings and abductions, is that there actually is a trail to follow. When having started with that list of questions on a small sheet of paper, from one discovery I was led to another and another, and it becomes very clear that something is happening. These events are all linked. It's one of the intriguing aspects of it that the mystery is hidden in plain sight. Those who could read at the time, who read the manuscripts of William and Ralph, would have immediately known an awful lot of what it has taken me years to discover. Like, for instance, that when the children are being asked those questions and making those replies, that this would have been at a formal hearing conducted by a bishop. And then almost from further clues within it, you can say, oh yes, that was the Bishop of London. Okay, wait a minute, he's connected with, and so it goes on.
Yeah.
But people of the time would have been able to do that.
Indeed, yes. Yeah. Now, you've said, and this is recorded, that they had clothing of a colour and material never seen before. But is there recorded anywhere what they said those clothes looked like, or did the children say anything about it?
Unfortunately not. One of the most frustrating lines in the whole thing is in William of Newburgh's account. Mm. And to put this into context, one reason for taking this seriously is that William of Newburgh saw himself as a bit of a ghostbuster. And he didn't just accept every story of wonderful events and put it down, as some chroniclers did. He tried to investigate. In the case of the Green Children, he either went himself or he sent people to interview the witnesses, and he said it was the number and quality of the witnesses that had convinced him this incident happened. Yeah. But it bothers him, because if it is a miracle, it should illuminate some point of scripture, and it doesn't, and he can't figure out what's going on. And in the end, he more or less says, well, if it has pleased God to do this, it's not for me to question it, because I'm now convinced myself that it really took place. But at the end of his short section on wonderful events, he actually goes back to it, and he says, well, everything else that I've referred to could be attributed to, as he calls them, bad angels. Basically, he's talking about fairies or other spirits. He says, but the Green Children, he says, that really is beyond me. I cannot explain it. And, And it does not grieve me to have set down this most strange and wonderful event, he says. It's a great last line, isn't it?
Now, I seem to recall when I read about it years ago.
Sorry, just to stop you. I didn't answer your actual question.
Yeah. Right, okay.
The line where you really feel like throwing things is where he says, they gave many other details of the land that they came from to those who were inclined to be curious, but it would be tedious to set them down here.
Oh, dear.
And you're going, oh, no. If only we still had his notebook.
What a shame, yes. Yeah. Oh, well.
You never know.
That would have been the icing on the cake, really, I think.
Well, yes. It would be, wouldn't it?
I seem to recall, as I was saying, when I read about it many years ago, and you're going to correct me if my memory is wrong, that when they first arrived, they didn't like or couldn't eat our food. So what I wondered is, did they say what their diet was or anything like that normally, from their original place?
Well, yes, as Sir David Frost would say, the clues are there, and they're very interesting. Initially, it seems, they were quite roughly treated. It was very quickly discovered that they were green all over, and they were put on public show for a time. And then wiser counsels prevailed, and they were taken to De Calna. But even then, they wouldn't eat anything that they were offered. And again, to my mind, this gets rid of all the refugee and runaway theories. Lost children adrift in medieval England, taken to the home of a guy who's only one step below a baron, only a half step below a baron, and told they can eat anything they like, would think they were in heaven. Yeah, they're not going to refuse ever. They're not going to refuse anything, much less refuse everything. Now, when they were showing serious signs of starvation, as it happened, bean plants were carried into the house. And they indicated by signs that they wanted these to be brought to them. And the very curious thing here is what they recognized was the color. They didn't know which part of the bean was edible. They had to be shown how to open the pods to get at the beans. They were looking for food in the stalks. So it was obviously some other kind of plant that they were used to. But for a considerable time, they would eat nothing but green beans. And this is interesting in relation to the boy's death, because it specifically says in the chronicle that he died of depression. And green beans contain a compound called tyramine, which accentuates melancholia. People who are subject to depression are advised to avoid green beans.
Really?
And that's an interesting thing in itself. But she said all the people, and by implication all the plants, she said all things, but in context it reads as if it's all plants in the land that they came from, were dyed with the same green colour. And I've gone into the medical side of this in quite considerable depth. Apparently there is nothing but vegetable dye that will turn people green in any ordinary circumstances. So, of course, the colour faded with time, and people thought it was because they'd begun eating our food. But it does again suggest that the word she uses when she's asked in the hearing, why did you refuse food? She says, because we thought that all the food in this land was incomestibilia. Which is a very precise word. Things which are not to be consumed for nourishment. It implies that there was stuff in that land that she came from which they shouldn't or mustn't eat, and that they had a very strong taboo against it. And color, the color coding was the important thing. If you don't recognize the color, don't eat it. And it had really been instilled deeply into them. So, yes, we can't tell what they were eating, but we can tell that there was other stuff there that they didn't.
Would it be barking up the wrong tree to think that perhaps the green was connected with chlorophyll?
Oh, I think it will undoubtedly have been chlorophyll.
That they needed, in other words, that was their nutrition, perhaps?
Well, not as such. I did. A lot of people have said to me, maybe they had a dual metabolism and they could run on chlorophyll as well as hemoglobin. Yeah. But I've talked to biochemists about this, and I've had some very amusing answers. But essentially, it's not biomedically possible. As one chap said to me, it's like the joke about how the Irish decide they're going to start driving on the right, but they're going to phase it in. So to begin with, they'll start with the heavy lorries. He said, if you're trying to adapt human being to yeah. absorb solar energy using chlorophyll is really it's really on the same scale. It's just not going to work.
Yeah. Well, mind you, in some ways, this idea is not quite so daft, is it? If you ate tons of carrots and nothing else, you turn orange.
Mm. Yes, I've got a couple of paragraphs of similar cases. There was a couple in, I think it was in Latvia, who drank so much methylated spirit that they turned purple due to the vegetable dye they put in that to stop people drinking it. And there was a chap with a particular type of deficiency who startled surgeons here in Glasgow some years ago, because when they opened him up, he started to bleed green. But this is actually a known medical condition. But the thing is, it's not hemoglobin in the blood that makes us the colors that we are. It's the amount of melanin you have in your skin. People with green blood due to this particular deficiency don't turn green. They don't end up looking like Mr. Spock, or let alone bright leek green, as these children were. I'm trying to think of some of the other instances that I came across. There's a condition called Argyria, which is, as its name implies, to do with an overdose of silver compounds. Mm-hmm. And apparently there is a medicine on sale in the States, which is supposed to have various beneficial effects, but turns people blue. And there was even a chap who stood for president some years ago who was blue and didn't get elected. But arsenic poisoning turns people grey or white. As I say, I've got two or three paragraphs in which I list all the different colours you can go as a result of too much of things. But with green, the only thing apparently that actually turns people green is acute retention of bile products. And if the patient turns green, it's a sign of imminent death.
Which
clearly was not the case with the children, because they had to be pretty fit and healthy just to survive the treatment that they initially were subjected to.
Yeah, this thought of, shall we say, human-type beings having different colours, of course, is quite real if you believe that there are extraterrestrials such as the Pleiadians and others who between them have blue skin, green skin, different colour hair. So there are these variables amongst the human species.
Well, I'm getting into areas here where I'm pretty sceptical again. I mean, I don't know if you've ever interviewed Dr. Jack Cohen, have you?
Not knowingly.
No. Oh, well, he's an expert in the study of exobiology. He works with Jack Stewart, who's done a number of television documentaries on various scientific subjects. But Jack himself is, as he delights in telling young ladies when he's introducing himself, he's a reproductive biologist. And he has particularly interested himself in the question of non-terrestrial life and what it might be like and how it might be found. And one of his major points is that they're going to be very different from us because there are so many accidents on the line of human evolution that the chances that they would all be duplicated and to such an extent that you could produce something that looked recognizably human, he just doesn't accept at all. He thinks this couldn't possibly happen. His major point is knees and elbows. Because apparently all the four-limbed creatures on Earth are descended from a variety of fish called Gogonassis, which has been found in fossil form in Australia, whose fin joints correspond to the knees and elbows that we have and most four-limbed creatures have. And this is why a human being in costume can act the part of, for instance, a great ape or a bear, or two humans in costume can act a recognizable caricature of a horse or a cow in pantomime. It's because the knees and elbows are always in the same places. Mm-hmm. And basically what Jack is saying is if their knees and elbows are enough like ours that they look human, then they are human. And you're not going to find separate lines of development on other planets leading you to that same combination.
Yeah. Well, I was thinking more on the lines of other species that are humanoid that carry these different, if you like, specification. But if the human form at different stages because of interaction between these extraterrestrials was genetically engineered, I have read that this would be quite feasible.
I really would be very surprised because you'd expect the combination of proteins used to be different. Very probably the amino acids used would be different. Again, I'm thinking here, we're getting trailers on the TV at the moment for the John Carter movie that's coming out quite soon. And in Edgar Rice Burroughs' Mars novels, when John Carter goes to Mars, he marries a humanoid Martian woman with whom he conceives an egg. A son. Yes. He conceives a son who is hatched, to whom she gives birth as an egg, which then hatches. And when Carl Sagan was here in Glasgow and speaking in the Gifford lectures, he actually alluded to that at one point, and he said, it's about as likely as a successful mating of a human being with a petunia, and went on to explain why. I think we can take it that if the girl married and had children, she was human and originally from Earth, from Earth's stock.
Well, I must agree, when you look at it that way, just forget what their background was and about the story connected with them. You're quite correct. And if she married and everything from that time on was the result of what you expect with two normal human beings, no variations, no peculiarities as far as we know, then yes, it would seem to suggest that, which makes the whole thing seem even more mysterious, really, doesn't it?
It does. It's one of the things about it, which is quite striking, is that this story has a beginning, a middle, and an end. Mm. It seems as if things started to happen round about 1095 when the sky lit up and the aurora and the meteor showers started. And it goes on for another roughly 300 years with interruptions when the sun is quiet and nothing happening here either. And then it's when you go into what's called the Sporer Minimum, the mini ice age around about 1400, then it stops and it all stops. And I've looked long and hard, and I haven't found any indication that the contact continues beyond then. Supposing that it is contact, but I say I can hardly believe what I'm looking at. I mean, I've got the X-Files in the 12th century. That's a pretty remarkable thing. Right. But it's the only explanation I can find that fits all of the facts as we've given them. But if that is the explanation, then there is an end point. It stops at 1400 or 1402, to be that absolutely precise, and nothing else seems to happen after that.
Right. Now, Duncan, I'm going to have to stop you there. We've got a few minutes left, but I want you to have a chance to tell our listeners how and where they can inquire or order your book and any other information you might like to give, website address or whatever.
I'll do that very thing. The book is going to be published by a firm called Mutus Liber, in Edinburgh, who are bringing it out in May, probably the end of May this year, and it can be pre-ordered on Amazon, and the details are indeed on the website, which I am about to read out, which is www.childrenfromthesky.com. And that is www.childrenfromthesky.com. Alternatively, if you simply Google Children from the Sky Duncan Lunan, that will take you to the Amazon page. And as I said, the book can be pre-ordered. There are a number of other things that my wife and I are engaged in, which you'll find links to on the site. And if we start down those trails, we'll probably be here all night. But I will just mention that back in the late 70s, I built the first astronomically aligned stone circle in Britain for about 5,000 years. It was a jobs creation project under the Labour government of the day. It was never completed, and there's a move to get that done now. And I've signed a contract to write a book about that, which I have to complete by the end of April. But you'll find links to that on the Children from the Sky site. For the moment, focus, yes, www.childrenfromthesky.com.
Right, that's brilliant, Duncan. Thank you.
Thank you for that opportunity.
Very pleased to speak with you. It's been a very, very interesting subject. We can all go away and think a lot more about all that. So thank you very much for coming on. It was very enjoyable.
Thank you, Michael. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you very much. Well, friends, that was very interesting. Next week I have Mal Duane. She is a certified life and recovery coach and author of Alpha Chick. She is deeply involved with helping women discover and use their connection with the power within. And she can also relate to that through her own life experience when she was able to overcome a decades-long struggle with alcoholism. So thank you for being with me today. I hope you can make it next week. God bless you all. Thank you.